Okay.
Welcome, Eagles, to another episode of Tradcat Night Radio. I'm Eric Ajewski, founder and owner of Tradcat Night, the most viewed and followed traditional Catholic website in the world, ranked number one as it relates to traditional Catholicism by Alexa, top 20,000 website. Appreciate you all for all the prayers and support over the past 3 years. I want to make sure everyone is subscribed to Tradcat Night right now. Click that notification button, which is right next to it. It's a bell, so you are getting all of the latest information from Tradcat Night. In this information war, folks, I do need financial assistance, so click the PayPal button and get behind Tradcat Night. Continue to spread information of Tradcat Night, the articles, the videos. Invite your family, friends, and church members to this website. Again, so much information going out to you on a daily basis. And as you know, this past month, I've really been trying to hone in on pro-life issues, and I have another wonderful speaker today. Very profound testimony. And as you know, on this radio show, it's kind of more back and forth, but for her testimony, I'm really just going to let her go with it, and I'm just going to sit back and absorb it all and take notes and maybe ask a few questions at the end. This will be a shorter segment, about 30 minutes, so I really want to just hand it over to her right now. But we're going to be bringing on today Julia Holcomb, and she has a very profound story. I don't even know where we could really begin, Julia. I mean, I know you want to go probably a little bit into your past, maybe your childhood, but today we're going to be talking about abortion, you know, God's mercy, God's forgiveness. Maybe we'll get into a little bit of support groups for women who are dealing with abortion, coercion. But she has a very profound story, and she was the ex-girlfriend. Now, was it fiance also as well of Steven Tyler, the Aerosmith rock band star? I believe, if I read correctly, that was the case. So I will link a story from LifeSite News directly in the description box so you can really see visually everything that we're going to be talking about today. So, Julia, without further delay, I'm going to hand it over to you. And just wherever you would like to begin, again, I'm going to not interfere as much as I might have in the past, because this is a very profound testimony here.
Well, I usually begin by telling people that it wasn't a decision that I ever expected to make to speak publicly about my abortion or my relationship with Stephen. I'm a mother of 7 children. I've been married for 35 years. My husband and I just celebrated our anniversary, and I'm a faithful Catholic at this point in my life. My relationship with Stephen and my past abortion is a part of my life I had hoped to leave in the silence of the confessional. I didn't expect to have to speak about that publicly. When I met my husband, Brad, I told him about my past with Stephen and my abortion, but together we had made the decision never to tell our children about it. So my children had never heard anything about my abortion or my past relationship with Stephen. When Stephen wrote his first memoir, he included me in his book, but he didn't use my name. So I had I didn't have to speak out about it because no one would know it was me. When he became an American Idol judge in 2011, he wrote his second memoir, Does the Noise in My Head Bother You? And in that second book, he again spoke about our relationship, my abortion, the fire that nearly took my life. And right before the publication of that book, Star Magazine ran a cover story with Stephen, a picture of him on the cover, and inside was a photograph of the two of us together, an account of my abortion and the fire, and it talked about him being my legal guardian. So here, my oldest son read about it on the internet, and my husband got a phone call, you know, from my son saying, "Dad, you know, I think there's a picture of Mom in the tabloids. I don't think it could be her, but I mean, I don't know how it could be her, but it looks like Mom." And so I had to give my first kind of silent no more talk at home with my children. And, you know, it was devastating to have to do that. My children had been raised devout Catholic. They had participated outside our local Planned Parenthood in sidewalk counseling with our church group, prayed the rosary, and tried to encourage young women who were abortion-minded to, you know, protect and be a guardian of life for their baby. So it was very difficult to tell them that I had had an abortion as a young girl, that I had once been the ward of Steven Tyler and just lived this, you know, crazy rock and roll life. So, you know, that's how all of this, you know, this really began, where I began telling my story publicly, I made the decision after telling them that I was going to be more vocal and speak out whenever I was invited against abortion and let people know how much most post-abortive women regret their abortion. That's certainly my case. I regret my abortion with all my heart. When people hear about my story, the first thing they usually want to know is, how in the world does a 15-year-old girl end up backstage at a concert and going home with a rock star? That's how my story begins. And it really starts with the breakdown of the family.
Okay.
My parents were divorced. My mother was just living with a man at that point. She had been divorced twice. And our family was just broken. And at 15, I met a young woman who had access to backstage parties. She told me that if I wanted to go to the Aerosmith concert, I could get backstage and I could meet Steven. And I just idolized him at that point in my life. I had heard him sing Dream on the radio, and I had a photograph of him on an album. So I knew who he was, and I had just, you know, idolized him much the way he is now. So I didn't think twice about whether I wanted to go with her. I can remember going to the concert with Penny and watching Steven sing and her taking me backstage and, you know, turning a corner, and there was Steven. And it was like my whole world just came to a stop. All I could see was him. I was just mesmerized with him. And I didn't go home that night, and really no one asked where I was. The next day, when I did finally go home, Steven told me that he wanted to take me with him to Seattle so that I could spend some more time with him. I remember coming home and telling my mother that I had stayed the night with him, that I had met him at the concert, and that he wanted me to fly to Seattle. And, you know, our family was so broken at that point that she actually drove me to the airport and helped me get my things together so that I could go. And by that summer, I had moved to Boston, and I was living with Stephen there at just 15 years old.
Wow.
It was quite a whirlwind of a year. It happened so fast. It was hard to really, you know, take it all in, that life could change so quickly. And while I was spending the summer there with him, he let me know that he wanted me to stay there with him and live with him. And after being there a few months, he said that I needed to become his ward, that he needed to be my legal guardian so that he could take me on tour. And he said I was too young to take across state lines, that it was illegal for him to have me with him there, and that he couldn't marry me, I was too young, but that he could become my guardian. He wanted my mother to sign these papers, and I can remember being really too young to fully understand what it all meant, but I knew that we wouldn't be married, that he would be my ward, almost like a parent, but also I'd be living with him as his lover. And it was very surreal. I can remember feeling like I had lost everyone in my life, that I no longer had my family, and that Stephen was really kind of the last, you know, he was the person who was my family at that point. I told him I didn't think my mother would sign those papers over to him, but he, you know, he got her to sign them. He had them within just a few months of bringing them to her. He had convinced her that if she didn't sign them, I wouldn't be able to go to school. And so she did. She signed over custody of me to Stephen. But I didn't go to school. I began touring with Stephen in the band. I can remember feeling like I was lucky, that, wow, this was so exciting. You know, we were traveling in limousines and going to these big hotels and huge arenas that were filled with fans that loved the band. I got to sit on the side of the stage at night and listen to the band perform, hear Stephen sing songs that some of them he had written for me. It was just seemed so fantastic. Like, I felt like I was just on top of the world with Stephen there. After, you know, we had been together some time, I can remember we had visited his family in New Hampshire, and his sister had been there with her baby. And he was reminded of how nice family was and how nice it was to have your family around you. We were in a large city, I think it was New York, and he asked me if I wanted to have his baby. He spoke to me of his desire to have a child of his own. And I can remember just feeling thrilled that he wanted me to have his baby. I thought, I was so young and naive, and I was so used to seeing these bohemian versions of the family. You know, with Stephen, he had a lot of friends that kind of lived together. They had children. They weren't married. And this was a version of the family that I had seen modeled for me, and it was something I saw as wholesome and good. It maybe wasn't traditional, but it was what I had seen. And so I wasn't really afraid of that invitation. I gave him my birth control pills, and he tossed them off the balcony of the hotel where we were staying. And at that point, we became open to life in this relationship. You know, it wasn't right away, but before the end of the year, I became pregnant. And Stephen had been on the road for a few weeks. He came back, and I remember telling him that I was pregnant. And I can remember he jumped. It was almost like he had forgotten that I wasn't using any birth control. And yet he was very kind and reassuring to me. He told me that everything was going to be all right, that he would take care of me. And he told me I would not be allowed to see a doctor because of I was underage, and he said the doctor would ask who the father was and that he could get in trouble. So I wasn't allowed to go to a doctor. But within a few months of the news breaking that I was expecting a baby, he told me that he had spoken to his attorneys and that we were going to have to get married, that because I was underage and he was my guardian and the baby was his, that he didn't have a choice in us marrying. And it kind of frightened me at first, but at the same time, I was also thrilled. I knew the baby was coming. I thought, well, this isn't not an ideal way to get married, but after we're married, everything will be okay and we'll be a family, so don't worry about it. You know, marriage is so sacred, and you know, we just kind of trampled all over it in the way we approached our relationship. So, you know, the end of the story is that Stephen changed his mind before the baby came and decided that he didn't want to go through with the marriage. He left me in our apartment and began his next tour without me. And, you know, I can remember being at least 5 months pregnant. I don't know for sure how far along I was because I was not allowed to see a doctor. And I was very thin. When he left me in the apartment to go on tour, he gave me, you know, I had like about $40. There were some groceries in the house, but after a few weeks, I had spent the money on food, and I was running out of food to eat. He would call me in the evenings and just check on me to see how I was doing. And I can remember telling him that I was down to milk. You know, I was basically 5 months pregnant and living on milk. And I had dropped out of high school. I had no education. I didn't have a driver's license or a vehicle. I had no way to go anywhere. I had no money and I had no family. I was just there all alone in that little apartment in Boston. And he told me that he would send his friend Ray to the apartment the next morning to take me grocery shopping. And Ray was someone who did, he was kind of like a roadie. He did things for the band at times. So I was really happy. I thought, this is going to be a good day tomorrow. I'm going to get to go somewhere. I'll buy food. I'll get out of the apartment. And I got up and waited for Ray to come. I let him in the apartment when he arrived. And that's the last clear memory I have before I woke up in a fire. That apartment, we hadn't left. We didn't go shopping. Ray was gone. I woke up and the apartment was full of smoke, just so thick I couldn't see or breathe. And I remember just being filled with an adrenaline rush. And I stood up and tripped over a coffee table that was in front of the sofa where I was laying. And when I hit the floor, I could see, because there was about 2 feet where the smoke wasn't, you know, so thick.
Right.
I could breathe a little bit. I caught my breath. and I could see where the front door was, and I started crawling to the door, but the lock on the door was jammed. I couldn't open it. So I started crawling for the back stairs that led down into a kitchen area where there was a back door. And when I got there, that's where it seemed like the smoke and the fire was coming from, those stairs. And I couldn't go down the stairs. I ended up taking refuge in a fireplace that had been in our bedroom. It was one that was there. It was a beautiful fireplace. We'd never used it. It was kind of like white marble. And when I lay down inside the fireplace, the flue was open, and there was a little bit of air at the very bottom. But I had inhaled so much smoke that I was about to pass out. And I knew that I wasn't going to get out of that fire and that I was about to die.
Wow.
I can remember this terrible feeling of dread coming over me, that I knew I wasn't prepared for death, that I had committed many grave sins, and that, you know, I really felt that I deserved to go to hell for the way I had been living my life. But I remembered going to church as a little girl and being taught that Jesus had died for my sins, that he loved sinners so much that he died on the cross for sinners, and that he would forgive us if we prayed for his forgiveness. And over the fireplace where I was laying was a picture of Jesus that my grandmother had given me. She had given me an old picture of Jesus as a child. It was called The Light of the World. And I had hung it over that fireplace because it reminded me of her. And at that moment, as I was laying there, I remembered it was there. And I kind of pictured Jesus as being like that child, very, very gentle and kind and forgiving. And I remembered also another thing my grandmother had done when I was little. If I had been naughty, she had me memorize Bible verses. And when I could say the Bible verse by heart, then she would say I was forgiven. And she would give me a hug and say, all's forgiven. And, you know, I must have been naughty a few times, because I had memorized a lot of Bible verses from my grandmother, from having her teach me those. And at that moment, laying there on the ground, I remembered them. And I remembered praying the words of a psalm that were an echo of Christ's words as he died on the cross. And I thought of that as a prayer for mercy. And I prayed, into thy hands, Lord, I commend my spirit. Thou hast redeemed me, O Lord God of truth. And that's the last thing I remember. I remember feeling peace come over me, that I wasn't afraid anymore, and that I expected to die. But I woke up in the hospital. Some very brave firemen pulled me out of that fire, and they had to revive me. I was unconscious and not breathing, and I woke up in the hospital. And Stephen was there. He was very shaken. He told me they didn't think I would live, and that if I did live, I would have had brain damage from the smoke inhalation. It was very, you know, just, yeah. I felt so filled with hope that I was alive. My baby was okay. I was still carrying my baby. Stephen was there, and I felt, well, everything's going to be okay. But it was really there that the worst ordeal began, because before I could leave that hospital, Stephen came to me and told me that I was going to have an abortion. Mm. And, you know, I knew what abortion was, but it was very new. It was something that was had just become legal. I had never even considered having an abortion. I was so happy to be carrying my baby. I loved my baby. I wanted my baby. But it didn't seem like anyone cared what I wanted. It was basically, I was being told that I didn't really have a choice, that this was a choice Stephen was making for me. And it was just shocking to me. I can remember always being very, very passive, very docile as a young woman, as a young girl. And this was really one of the first times I began to argue with Stephen. We argued for a couple of hours. Finally, in the end, it came down to Stephen told me I could have that abortion, or I could get out. I could hit the street. Maybe my mother would take me back. I wasn't sure what I would. I was so frightened. My mother was thousands of miles away on the other West Coast, and I didn't know how to. I just didn't know what would happen. And, you know, when you hear about abortion in the United States, sometimes we see these women that are very radical feminists, you know, protesting for abortion. We think, well, maybe that's what all post-abortive women are like. But the truth that's not the truth. And sometimes we hear about coerced abortions happening in places like China. And we think, well, that happens there, but it doesn't happen here in the United States. You know, the truth is that over 60% of the abortions that happen here in the United States involve coercion. Most young women are coerced into abortion by family members or boyfriends, or that they are being pushed to have that abortion or get out of their home, lose their families. And often they're just terrified. They feel that they have no choices being presented to them. You know, now there's so many more options for young women because there are many women's shelters. There's so many women's health centers where they can go and they can get housing, they can get help, they can get medical care. And, you know, I just encourage any woman out there who's in a position where she's being coerced into an abortion and she doesn't want that, she wants her baby to see the light of day, to see a chance at life, that she would, you know, search out your local women's center, your local women's clinic, that they will help you find the resources to keep your baby. And even if you are being sent from your home, it doesn't matter how old you are, they'll help you find a place to stay and help you get on your feet. And I encourage anyone out there who's in that position to just look for a women's clinic. But I ended up just caving in fear, and I had that abortion. And, you know, it was just devastating. I can remember afterwards being almost like a broken person. I felt like I had died with my baby, that I had lost my relation. Even though I had lived so sinfully, I still knew that God existed, and I had been given the grace to pray for help in that fire. But after the abortion, I just felt like I had permanently separated myself from God with this horrible abortion, that there wasn't really any pathway back for me, that I was lost forever. And, you know, when we got to our new apartment, Stephen brought me my picture of Jesus that had been hanging over that fireplace. It was black with soot. And he handed it to me, and he said it was the only thing that had survived the fire. And I can remember just feeling overwhelmed that picture was back in my hands, that little, you know, image that reminded me of Jesus and his love for me, a sinner. And I took it in the kitchen. I got a cloth wet with just water, and I wiped off the black soot. It's amazing how that painting was so black I couldn't see the picture. And when I just took water, it wiped right off. It was so clean after I cleaned it. That picture still today is in our family. My oldest son has it in his home. And it's so precious to me because it's such a symbol of how approachable Jesus is. He's so loving and kind. He's like a child. We don't have to be afraid to turn to Christ. But, you know, very soon, Stephen sent me home, and I was just a broken person. And I remember I used to wake up dreaming of the fire, dreaming of that abortion, just almost, you know, almost terrified to go to sleep at night. And at that point, my mother had begun to return to God herself. And she was in a position where she was praying for me. I was the one who was such a mess that she was praying for me. And she and my stepfather invited me to go to a church camp. And I can remember I wasn't interested in church, but it was at the beach. And I loved the coast, so I went. And that was where my whole life changed. I met young people there who were Christian. I hadn't been around anyone my own age in so long. I'd been around this world of, you know, this rock and roll culture filled with adults. And here at this coast, at this church camp, there were young people who were so wholesome. I can remember just being stunned by their sweetness. And I remember feeling like I was happy there for the first time in so long. We prayed together. We sang hymns together. I remember walking the beach with these young people, having bonfires and just having fun, but doing it in a way that incorporated faith in Christ in every activity. By the time I left, you know, when I first got there, I can remember looking at the girls and thinking, well, it's a good thing I'm here because these girls could use some makeup tips. You know, they could learn how to put on some eyeliner and they might be a little happier with their lives. But by the time I left, I had learned that they were the ones who had what I needed. They had a relationship with Jesus. And they had explained to me that Christ would forgive me if I got down on my knees and asked for his forgiveness, that he would take me by the hand and start leading me on a new path. And that's what I did. When I got home, I began attending church. I was baptized. I joined the choir. And, you know, I began a very slow process of healing. I started memorizing Bible verses at a little Baptist church I attended in college. The pastor there said he wanted all of the young people to memorize Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7. That's the Sermon on the Mount. And when I would wake up in the night with nightmares, I began to listen to his advice. I'd open my Bible and start memorizing those scripture passages that begin, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." I started there and I went all the way through those. You know, it took me a few years, but I began to change. I embraced chastity. I embraced this, you know, just Christ in a radical way. And the scriptures began to form my conscience. I began to build a conscience through God's word. And within a few years, I was so different. You just couldn't even recognize me. I looked like a different person. I was a different person inside and out. And that's when I met my husband. And he was just the best thing that ever happened to me. He had just graduated from college as a chemical engineer. And he had played football in college. He had ended up going to a Fiesta Bowl with his University of Wyoming team. And he was just an amazing young man. And I knew after a short time of our friendship that he was about to ask me to marry him. And I knew that I had to tell him about my past. Because looking at me the way he had met me, he would never have dreamed that I had ever known Stephen or had an abortion. And, you know, it was just a terrifying thing to realize that I had to tell him about my past and that it might end our relationship. I can remember visiting with my sister about it, and she told me, you know, don't tell him. He'll never know. It's just water under the bridge, and it'll ruin everything if you tell him. And I said, no, I can't begin our life like that on a lie. I have to tell him the truth. And I did. I told him the truth, and, you know, he cried with me. It was painful for him to hear, but he gave me a hug, and he said, that's not who you are anymore, and you'll never be that person again. And, you know, we did get engaged, and we began this beautiful family that we have now. I'm so thankful. God is so generous and so forgiving, and he has been good to me. I have 7 beautiful children.
Wow. Absolutely amazing story, Julia. I know this has touched the hearts of those truly listening to us. You know, although our stories are different, they are somewhat similar. Most of you know my, you know, personal background in terms of breaking free from sex addiction and pornography and basically using young females, you know, for sex and manipulating and controlling. And then I turned to the Blessed Virgin Mary. Yes. And that was the catalyst for me. And I haven't been without a rosary or scapular around my neck in years and years and years. And so, you know, conversion is a process, folks. It's all about, you know, do you want it? Do you want God? You know, your walk with Christ will be as far as you want to go with it. I would just offer that it's consistency day in and day out. We got to avoid mortal sin. We're all sinners. So we, in the very least, are going to venially sin. As Catholics, we know this, but we truly got to avoid the mortal sins. And that's kind of like how we can kind of present the story of Julia, where, you know, at one point she was a prisoner basically in her house. And that's what mortal sin will do to us. Yes. Interiorly, is we become prisoners, and only Christ can break us free. And I just offer, you know, run to the Blessed Virgin Mary, because those who are who go deep with Mary, so to speak, will be the most intimate with Jesus. This is how the saints basically summarize it. And let us, you know, this message also hits home because I try to get out there the message of Fatima, which truly is about repentance and conversion in the end, and about God's mercy and forgiveness. And let's take a look at the example of Saul. You know, Saul was a murderer and eventually became Catholic. He became Saint Paul, and
it's his feast day today.
Yeah, and so we have, you know, probably the most profound statement from the Word of God on love, you know. And so that's what it's about, folks. It truly is. Don't count anyone out. I know people were praying for me just as people were praying for Julia. And that's why I wanted to just let her go with this talk today. It's just so amazing to hear the conversions of others. And wow, that's all I have to say. So silent no more, Julia Holcomb. Again, I'm going to put this article from LifeSite News in the description box so you can read further on the matter. I guess I just one question before I do let you go. It's been 30 minutes. It's hard to believe. But what has been the response that you've been getting since you've been coming out? I mean, I would imagine that there would be a lot of trolls, if you will, a lot of nasty comments. But I mean, for the most part, have people been receptive to...
Most of the people that hear my story have been very happy that I've shared with them, especially Christians or people that are looking to... are kind of in that process of conversion themselves. So, you know, it's funny how it's the Christians in my life that have been the most forgiving. It's often those that have, you know, made the fewest mistakes who are the least likely to condemn others who make mistakes. At least that's been my experience. I also, I really appreciate your mentioning Mary as a Catholic. You know, Mary is that beautiful apostle that of Christ, that she is that excellent example of a guardian of life. And really all of us, we're all called to follow that example of being guardians of life and protecting that gift of life, that great gift that God gives us.
Yeah, that's it in a nutshell. She is the mother of life. Life himself is Jesus Christ, the mother of peace, the mother of mercy. Wow, it's just so profound. Julie, I truly do appreciate you coming on today and sharing your story. And folks, again, listen, we're entering into a time period which I think most Christians can kind of see is on the horizon, to where we truly are going to have to keep our wings spread in faith and hope. And this is a story about that, about ultimately having faith and hope and conversion. Again, don't count anybody out, because I guarantee you there's going to be people who are surrounding you right now that you're pointing at saying, well, he'll never get his act together. She'll never get his act together. Yeah. Whether they're pregnant or not, whether they're addicted to pornography, whether they're addicted to drugs. I mean, at one point, I was like that. I was in and out of the clubs, and you know, I was living the American dream, and I never would have thought that I would be here talking to you and running this apostle as I am today. And it truly goes to show you how, you know, especially the rosary, but just prayer in general. So prayer, mm-hmm. offer up your sacrifices, and truly stand by side with Jesus Christ and Our Lady. And my good friends, please do keep me in prayer. Keep Julia in prayer. Once again, I appreciate Julia coming on today. And until next time, my good friends, stay safe and God bless.